One, two, three.
Welcome to Three Song Stories, the podcast and radio show that brings out the storyteller and our guest by challenging them to come up with three songs that are indelibly linked to moments in their lives. Thanks for listening. I'm Mike Kinirie. Our guest this week is Stacey L. Holman. Stacey's a Harlem-based filmmaker who's a proud graduate of Dillard University in New Orleans and the New York University's Tisch School of the Arts graduate film program. She has directed and or produced a number of award-winning projects, including an episode of the 2018 PBS series Reconstruction, America After the Civil War, hosted by Henry Louis Gates Jr. She was a producer on the critically acclaimed documentary Tell Them We Are Rising, the story of Black colleges and universities, and she was an associate producer on the Emmy Award-winning film Freedom Riders. Stacey was also coordinating producer for the Peabody Award-winning documentary Freedom Summer, and she was co-producer on Mary Lou Williams' The Lady Who Swings the Band. Her documentary Dressed Like Kings, filmed in Johannesburg, South Africa, garnered the Tribeca Film Festival All Access Award and aired on the World Channel as part of the Afropop Shorts program. And for more than 10 years, Stacey has taught future filmmakers at the City College of New York and MFA candidates at Fairleigh Dickinson University in Madison, New Jersey. Stacey came across our radar when she joined me on our radio show, Gulf Coast Life, back in February to talk about the new four-part PBS documentary series Gospel, which she was series producer and director of alongside her collaborator, Shayla Harris. Hey there, Stacey. How are you?
I'm good. Michael, how are you?
I'm doing very well. Nice to talk to you again. How is Gospel doing?
Gospel is doing amazing. The response has been overwhelming. We're still getting emails from people who it's either jarring a fond memory or just introducing them to the genre itself. And it's great. It's great. So I think this one's a winner. For sure. I mean, they all are winners, but this one I think is definitely resonating with people in a very special and unique way that, and it's music, you know, it's music. Music's, you can take music anywhere. So I think that's one element of it that it's just really had the response that it's had.
When I talked to you on Gulf Coast Life, I asked if you were going to be watching it. What was it like seeing it? You know, did you have like a little watch party or something when that first episode came out?
I did. I had two watch parties. So the first group, everyone really loved it. And everybody, there was folks who kind of can hum along with the songs, others who just, you know, absorbed it. And everybody really, all my friends, they liked it. Not just because I did it. They really liked it.
Okay, so let's go back to first principles here. Where did you grow up and how would you describe the musical background of your childhood?
Oh my gosh, that is a great question. I'm born and raised in Cleveland, Ohio, in a suburb, actually, I should say, Shaker Heights. People correct me, you're from Shaker Heights. So it's just right on the border of Cleveland. And it's known for being a very utopia of Black, white, Jews, Christians, you know, all living, you know, in harmony, really a community that's just blended. And, you know, somewhat, you know, upper middle class of, you know, very rich community. And so I grew up, I should say, with three older siblings, and I am the youngest of the four. And there's 11, 9, and 7 year age gap. So growing up in Shaker Heights in a community that's very diverse, as was the music in my family. And we had a lot of top 40 stuff. So of course there's a lot of stuff that, you know, I think my ears were kind of protected from because of just some of the lyrics at that time. Like there was an Elton John song and he used the word damn it, and my brother was trying to have me, if legend has it, or history is told, is like he tried to have me say a different word so I wouldn't say the word damn it. Somebody saved my life tonight. That was a song.
That helps us. I mean, that helps us gauge like what was considered too far. Damn it was too far. So continue.
Exactly. It's like, what if we only knew? If we only knew. Damn it is like the, it's just like a nice word, you know, it's a safe word. So anything from like, you know, my parents were like, it's interesting. My parents listened to a lot of more Black artists, and my siblings were really, particularly my brother, who actually he was a DJ at Dartmouth, and he would bring home like the top 40, the Casey Kasem. I am so dating myself, but these are great memories, you know. These are like, oh, Casey Kasem, and you know, it's top 40 music. So we had anything from, you know, the Bee Gees, from Donna Summer. I remember we had the Grease album. We also had, what was the album? I think it was the album cover always scared me because I never liked looking at it. But I think it was the one, I don't know if this will help you remember. It was the album cover where there's a woman who was actually being buried alive. And it was very scary as a kid. So, you know, it was very eclectic in terms of just what we listened to. And I always was really big on, like, after church, I always loved listening to Casey Kasem because that was like, oh, this song and that song. But, my siblings just kind of really were really big on just different kinds of music. And they were a different personality, too. So
what would be the first band or musician that got your attention independent of your parents or your siblings' influence?
Oh, my gosh. This is funny. I would say this is a little bit later, only because I think the song drew my friends crazy. I'm probably going to think of a song later on, but this is the one that comes to mind immediately. La Bamba, Los Lobos.
Oh.
I just was obsessed with that song, and I was like, I love this group. So, but I feel like there's like another one. You would think it would be something like, there were so many groups back then too, like the Jackson 5, but that was the one, which I like the Jackson 5, but I feel like I'll have a better answer later for that one.
Well, let's
right
try,
now it's Los Lobos.
Let's try it this way. What was the first music that you owned that was yours to possess, either that you purchased or asked for specifically as a gift or something?
Oh, I think it would be the Grease album.
Hmm.
I loved Grease. Yeah.
We had the 8-track of Grease when I was a little kid, and we would listen
to it.
Oh,
my gosh.
Me and my brother and sister would listen to it over and over and over.
It was, I mean, and then also we had the album covers, you know? I mean, it was just like a photo album. You're going looking at all the images and like, oh, this picture, that. Yeah, it would be Grease.
Do you have any musical memories at all that stem from your grandparents?
Most of my memories would be with my maternal grandparents, and it's really based, we had a piano, they had a piano in their house and church. I don't remember there being really any records played, but, you know, Sundays were a big thing because we went to church, and just the music there, which was gospel, which, you know, cut fast forward to what I'm doing now. But they had, you know, like I said, the piano was there and my grandmother would play. My uncle was an incredible pianist, classical. I mean, you just tell him a song and he could just play it automatically. So I think it was more so live music that was more present in my grandparents' home than anywhere, you know, than like a record player or even an album of any sort.
What about the first time you saw music performed live that wasn't, you know, a church performance or something like that?
Okay, this is really funny. My first memory of a concert was Mr. Rogers.
Wow. What does that mean?
That means, I know. He's like, you saw Mr. Rogers in the concert. I loved, and I continue to love, I guess you have to use past tense since he's no longer here, but I loved Mr. Rogers growing up. And he performed at, there was an auditorium in Cleveland. And my friend, I think I was like in kindergarten or something like that. We went to go with our mothers to see Mr. Rogers, and he was a classical pianist. So he played the piano, and that's all I literally remember, just seeing him come on stage. And that's like the memory that I have. But that was my first concert. So PBS has been with me for such a long time. Clearly, I've been a fan of it.
Was he in the outfit he changes into once he gets into the world, or was he wearing what he comes in the room with? You know what I mean? Like, we all know Mr. Rogers going through that transition. You know, I put on the sweater now.
I remember him wearing the sweater, because that's his signature. You know, you got to come out what your fans love. You got to wear what your fans, what your little kid fans love you to wear and know you to wear. So, yeah, it's like it's the weirdest thing to say, yeah, Mr. Rogers. But it's the coolest thing, too, because he just really was very informative in my childhood years, clearly.
Yeah, no, I think that's super cool. It'd be like my first concert was Kermit the Frog.
Exactly. And Ralph was on the piano.
Okay, Stacy, let's do your first song.
Okay.
How would you like to proceed? You want to listen to it, or you want to tell a story to tee it up?
Let's just tee it up.
Okay. This is Stacy Holman's first song on this week's episode of Three Song Stories. This is Tony Bennett singing Fly Me to the Moon live at Sony Studios in New York City in April of 1994 as part of MTV Unplugged.
I first heard this song in the 90s watching TV. And there was a commercial, because we had those lovely commercials that interrupted our program that we couldn't fast forward through. And it was a Sony commercial. I do not know what Sony was advertising. I guess it was Sony Music. And Tony Bennett was, I believe it might have been San Francisco, driving down the street in a convertible. And this song was just playing. And just his smile was infectious. The song just was like, lifted me up. You know, this is during the time I'm in film school. And the next day, I remember I was on a shoot because we worked on each other's productions. And I just kept humming the song. And I just became a fan of his music. And fast forward, so much so that my friends, I kept telling them, I like Tony Bennett. I mean, friends would give me, you know, his covers, like Duet, you know, one of my like a second sister to me, got me tickets to one of his concerts. Another friend was working at NBC at the time. And for my birthday, remember they had the outdoor concerts. And she was like, he's going, you know, I can get you in. And I remember seeing him just like 6 o'clock in the morning. So it was really early. I remember seeing him going into, after I guess he did a tech run, he went inside to rest up before he performed. And then he came out and performed, and there was like a bunch of older women and this one black guy who I guess is a regular staple out there for all the live performances. And then there was me, and there was other crowds, but we were like toward the front, and he's shaking the hands of everybody else. And I don't know why I was looking crazy at him, but he's just kind of was like, oh, this is an interesting person to be here. He's a big fan of my music. But I just, you know, just his voice is just a warmth to it. There's just a certain power to it. And we fast forward a little bit later to the 2000s. And I was working, I was struggling with getting film work. So I had to take a job of humility, as I call it. And, it was a blessing too, in the same way. So I was on my break for the job, and I'm walking down the street, this is like in the 50s, and I look over and I see this man walking with an older gentleman walking with a younger gentleman. And I'm like, wow, that's Tony Bennett. And I literally had a whole just conversation with myself. And I'm like, wow, there's Tony Bennett. I'll meet him one day. And then there's like the other side of me was like, duh, you're going to meet him today.
Yeah, like
that
right
is
now.
What you're supposed to do. So it was just like, I just snapped out of it and I ran. So by this time, they're on one side of the street. I'm on the other side walking in opposite directions. So I turn around and I dart chasing after him. Of course, they do not see me chasing. And of course, you know, keep your cool. When you get close enough, you stop running. And you just briskly walk. And I said, you know, excuse me, Mr. Bennett. And he turned around and I just said, I am a huge fan of your work. I said, I am not a fan girl or a fan person who chases after a celebrity. That's just not me. However, when I saw you, I just was, you know, I just wanted to just say how much I appreciate you and I love your music and just say thank you. And then he was like, thank you. That, you know, he's like, you hear what he says, thank you. So he did thank you, thank you. And then I went on my way and he went on his way. And it just, oh, it just, even now I'm just like beaming. And it just, you know, one of my coworkers, I came back to work and I was like, guess who I met? Tony Bennett. And I was just, yeah, I just was floating forever and ever and ever. So it's a warm space. It's a warm memory for me. And it just, you know, whatever I'm kind of feeling in a day, I can just play that song and it just, and there's different versions of it, but I like the live version the best, probably because there's a little acapella and then just he has a little more of a rasp in it.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a beautiful, and just the words, the lyrics itself. Just fly me to the moon, you know, let me run the stars, you know, let me see what, you know, it's magical.
So two questions. First of all, what was the job? You kind of breezed mm-hmm. past what the job was.
I know. Well, my job was with the person who was giving me issues with my iPod, Apple.
Oh, okay. Okay. So second question is, you know, where do you remember exactly where that was in the city? And like, you know, you could go back there and like stand there and be like, this is where I met Tony Bennett.
Yeah, it was on 56 between 5th and 6th. So it wasn't too far actually from the Apple store. So it was on 58th. I'm sorry, it was 58th Street because we're going up 58th. Between 5th and 6th.
You should have a little tiny brass plate made that says Stacey Holman met Tony Bennett and then super glued to the ground.
I should. And only in New York will you can just see somebody and you can just either be like, oh, that's so-and-so, or you can just have a magical moment like that. And he was just, like I said, so generous too. You know, and even when you see, you know, people of note, you don't want to interfere. You should not, you know, they're people like all of us. And if they're going out for a reason. And he clearly was just going out for a walk. And someone's like, my friend, will you take a picture? I was like, no, I didn't want to take a picture. You know, it's just sometimes it's nice to just have that memory in your head, you know, because you spend, at least for me, I can spend so much time taking the picture and just getting taken out of that moment. But it's just magical just remembering it, what you felt and just what you recollect.
One of the first times I went to New York City in the early 90s, I was walking down the street as a relatively young guy, and I look up and I'm like, holy crap, that's Ani DiFranco walking right toward me.
And, oh my God.
And I just kind of looked at her and gave her a little nod, and she gave me a little nod, and I just kept on going. And it's like one of my proudest moments is I nodded to Ani DiFranco.
Yes. And it's that knowing nod. And celebrity, like, you see me, I see you, and thank you.
And I will never forget it. And I know she has no memory of me, but that's okay.
Like, this is a guy who respected my space and nodded, and I nodded back. It was great.
Oh, okay. Let's go back a little bit before we work our way forward again. Where did you fit into the scene when you were in high school? Were you, like, already doing filmy kind of stuff?
I wasn't. I really didn't blossom into film until like college, but that was more television and then grad school. But I could be a Pollyanna, you know, my mom calls me a Pollyanna among my siblings. And I think I was maybe a Pollyanna. And what I mean by that is I had friends in different circles. I had my academic friends. I had my friends who I may hang out with school. I had my social friends. And then I had my true ride and die besties. And so I wasn't like the most popular, but I wasn't the one that wasn't. So I kind of knew people. I wasn't active in any, I ran cross country for like a hot minute, but then I really became active in different organizations like SCORE, which is Student Group on Race Relations, which was formed by a group of high school students that realized, that once they got to high school, I should say it was formed by Black and white students. They realized that once they left elementary school, that once they got to middle school, a lot of their relationships with their Black friends fell off, and a lot of their relationship with their white friends fell off, and kind of where was that disconnect? So the organization was really bent on going into the in elementary schools, so sixth graders, and just developing trust, talking about relations of race and just relationship building. And so I was really active in that. And then there was the other organization, which was an all Black organization. So it's kind of funny. I swung on both sides of it. So, and that one was for the reason of just Black students really needed a space that they could really connect with each other. And, you know, we did a play. It was like the only play at the time that, from my recollection, that was an all-Black production. And that was done my junior year. And it was written by students. It was a musical. And it was kind of just a walk through history up into the Million Man, not Million Man, sorry, the March on Washington. So I feel like, yeah, I was kind of the kid who was engaged with stuff and could kind of talk with different crowds and kind of feel comfortable, mostly comfortable with it, you know?
Sounds like you didn't do any like theater or band or anything like that directly.
I didn't. And it was when I did that play, and I felt, I mean, I just felt that was not like my tribe. And it was a very, and I just remember the students that were a part of it. And in fact, one I'm still in contact with, they were a very, it was a click. It was a click. And I just didn't feel, you know, to be an artist, you have to put yourself out there. And I just don't think I was in a space to do that. I mean, like growing up, I used to make up plays at my grandparents, in my grandparents' basement. But I think just in that space, and I think when we did that play, that was through, and I wish I could remember the name of the Black organization. You know, that for me was just a liberating moment, because I felt it was a space that I felt safe to really, to, and that was part of the ensemble cast. So I felt, you know, safe in that ensemble cast to actually perform, and perform what I mean by like act. There's no, you know, I can sing in a choir of a thousands. You know,
so you know, you're a filmmaker now. Like you said, you didn't really get into that till you went to college or graduate school, even, I guess. But, you know, what did you see yourself heading toward at that point before you went away to college? Did you have anything, or were you just kind of moving forward?
I knew I wanted to do entertainment. I think there's other stuff I entertained. Like I found one of my like old journals a while ago, and one of my besties is in fashion. And I was like, one of my girls like, yeah, I want to do fashion. I'm like, what was I thinking? I didn't. I think just because she's doing it, I was like, oh, that would be cool. But I always really, I loved entertainment. And, oh, I should kind of preface that my older siblings, they all went into law, business, and education. And the only other industry that really interested me was psychiatry. But I was like, I don't want to go to school for that long. But I just knew I just liked the freedom of just entertainment. You know, I loved watching old movies with my stepmom and just going to movies with friends. So when I got to college, the opportunity to major in communications, where my dad was like, oh, Black folks major in communications. I'm like, well, then I'm just another Black person that majored in communications. but I just knew that was just, I just didn't see myself doing numbers. You know, chemistry I failed at in high school. So I was like, no, thank you. And education, even though I come from a long line of educators as a career, just didn't interest me. And I just really felt like creating things. And there's a certain freedom that I liked about that. And when it came time to go to apply to grad school, and that's one thing my father is a big educator promoter. So when you're in middle school, he's asking you what college you want to go to. And when you're in college, he's like, what grad school do you want to go to? I'm like, dude, like, let me just finish sixth grade, you know, let me get through 11th grade. So I had that top of mind as I was leaving Dillard University in New Orleans. And when it came time, something just told me to apply to NYU Film School. And sometimes it's just good not to know what you're getting yourself into, because I did not know it was a top film school at the time. I did not know that they only accepted 30 students. And, you know, I applied and I got in.
Why did you go to New Orleans for college? Was it because it was New Orleans or because it was the college?
Combination of both. A lot of my classmates, it was when I was finishing, it was at the height of, you had school days, and a lot of my friends who were the class ahead of me were going to HBCUs, and which is historically Black colleges and universities. And my stepmom attended Cheney University and graduated. My dad attended Fisk for a year and unfortunately couldn't finish, and then he went on to Ohio University. However, he talked more about Fisk than he did the 3 years at OU where he graduated. And even my mom, who didn't go to an HBCU, was really encouraging. So I just really felt like the space that I wanted to be part of was predominantly Black. And, you know, even though as diverse as Shaker presented itself to be, I mean, it was not without its issues and challenges. And I think to be in a space where you see people like you, where you're competing more against yourself than against others. And what I mean by that is, you know, sometimes in spaces where you're the minority, you're competing to be there, where I'm competing against myself at Dillard. And my dad, and the other side of it, a lot of my classmates were either going to Howard or Hampton or FAMU. And I was kind of like, yeah, I didn't really want to go to those, not because they were not great schools, but because it's like everybody was going to them. And my dad was the one who told me about Dillard. And we went to visit, and I tell you, it just felt like home. It's a gorgeous campus, not because I went there, but because, I mean, it's these gorgeous, like, white structured buildings across this incredible yard that's lined with oak trees. And I just stepped foot on campus, and I was like, this is where I need to be.
We normally ask if guests have any musical memories associated with their time in college, but I'm guessing having gone to college in New Orleans, there's at least one or two musical memories there, right?
Oh, gosh. Well, it may not be the jazz that people are thinking about, but yes. You know, there is definitely, I mean, the music that came out of New Orleans, the Dirty South, was just very unique, especially ones that were by New Orleans artists. There was one, I can't remember the name of the actual song, but anytime you can incorporate a biscuit in your lyrics, you know, that's a great song. You know?
Oh, wait, that's ringing a bell. Look that up, Jared. There's something going on in my brain with a biscuit song.
Yeah,
so continue.
Can I get biscuit?
There's one that says, "Give me what you got for pork chop." I say, and I can't stop. It's like stuff like the beat was just like sick. And the lyrics were just like, okay, this makes no sense, but this is great. Then at that time, you have the dance that was a P-pop, which is almost kind of like twerking. Beats.
Is it Right There?
Okay, it's Right There, song by Chinging. Let me see. It's Give Me What You Got for a Pork Chop is literally the name of the song.
Let's hear a little bit.
Oh, 1993?
Yes.
Oh, got it. Okay.
Here's another story about a brother named Free.
Can you hear it?
Yeah, I can hear it.
Okay.
Where's the biscuit?
I think there's a biscuit in this song, but it's definitely a pork chop.
Give me what you got for a pork chop.
There it is.
This ain't Jimmy and I won't stop. I'ma show a style that is perfect. Dropping the boom, shaking the room, making the ladies walk. Get the underground street sound, straight from the F-Town. Pumping on the radio, so turn up your stereo. Some stuff to try to test me because I'm from Tennessee. They want to say I'm country, but I'm driving smoky style beat. Artists try to stress, but I guess that is best.
So remind me why we were listening to that.
That was the song that was my senior year at Dillard. And so that was one of my musical memories. New Orleans and just this new music. Oh, it was new coming. I don't know how new it was, but it was relatively new. That was just coming out of the South, and didn't hear it when I went back up North. I'll tell you that. But just the drop beat, all of it was just, we get all of us on the dance floor. It was in the clubs. It was, you know, we had, I was a member of a sorority. So a lot of people, they had step competitions, and artists would come out, not artists, but Greek letter organizations who were stepping would come out to that song, or, and then that would just get the crowd just all riled up. So, yeah, it was a hype song.
Trip down memory lane with the song that has pork chop in the lyric.
That's pork chop. Yes.
Did you, you mentioned, okay, we're going to go back ahead a little bit here. You mentioned you went to NYU for film school. Did you go straight on from one to the other, or did you take time in between? And did you have already, you must have made something with film or video in order to get in, I think, or explain that.
Yeah, I did go straight from undergrad to graduate, and you do have to submit a portfolio. And what's interesting with NYU is you can submit photography, you can submit artwork, and you can submit, obviously, films. And because Dillard at the time did not have a film program, they do have one, excuse me, they do have a film program now. I did a lot of stuff that was deemed, when I went through my interview, viewed as documentaries. So I submitted short videos, one of a production that I put on that was like a fashion show. I did a documentary on my grandmother, who we had like an 80th birthday celebration for her. So I did a video surrounding that. The funny part about that video is each of the grandchildren told sections of her life. And there's a story about how she met my grandfather, and my grandfather had a friend who my grandmother was dating, and he went away and he was like, take care of Mary Frances. And he took care of Mary Frances because he married Mary Frances. But the funny part is that when I was telling the story in the video, I showed the wrong picture. I realized this later. I showed a relative. I thought there was a picture of the guy, and it wasn't the picture. It was actually a grandfather. I said was the guy that my grandmother was dating before my grandfather. So I don't know what the video is anyway, but so I submitted that, and that's what got me into the program.
I'm trying to do the math here. I'm thinking around that time you may have been shooting on like a Hi8 camera or something. Would that have been what you were using? How were you editing at that point?
Oh, was not with Avid, that's for sure.
Yeah,
this is where you had to, it was like linear. So if you messed up, you had to start all the way at the beginning to drop stuff in. It was, oh my gosh, it was very stressful. Yeah.
What was the first film that you made that you consider yours?
Oh my gosh. I would say I did my first NYU film was called Castles. I think it was Castles in the Sand or Castles. And one thing they told you when you shot your first film at NYU was, don't shoot with animals, don't film with kids. And guess what? A lot of us shot with animals and a lot of us shot with kids, and I was one of them. And we shot on the beach, you know, that's always great for film. We're shooting on actual film, by the way. This is not digital, this is 16 millimeter film. So that's always a wonderful thing to shoot with when you're shooting on a beach. So I remember filming that, and it was this incredible, first of all, I'd never worked with film before, and to work with just some adorable kids, and it worked out because some of the faculty I cast three of the, we had two faculty members who had kids, and I cast their children. So that would be like the first one. I was like, this is mine. But my second one, I would say was really mine, is one that really went through the festival circuit, was Mira Mira. And that was it would be my third film, but my film the second one also had audio and stuff, but it was my second year film, just kind of give things in kind. So you had to do a total of four films at NYU. So this was my third film. And that one was set in New York, about a race-based film that really kind of spoke to a little bit of a parody of just some of the old wives' tales about what would make you dark, what would make you light, and just kind of just, and this is stuff like, for example, one of the characters' mother, or the main character's mother, and the main character's a model, I should just preface, who's played by Nicole Ari Parker, who is on, what is the show with Sarah Jessica Parker now? The reboot of Sex and the City? Yeah. So anyway, so this is, Nicole went to NYU as well, but she had finished by this time. So she was my lead actress in it. So the whole scene is played out where the mother comes to visit. She's played by Harriet Mandeville. and she sees coffee in her daughter's cabinet. And she's like, what's this? And the daughter's like, coffee. And she's like, don't you know coffee will make you darker? So it's just, and that's really a true thing, that Black people actually would think that you can get darker by drinking coffee. So it was this kind of this trope on just these ridiculous things that people thought would happen to you if you did certain things or if you drank certain things. So so that film got a lot of recognition and was really next to the one with the castles, I think was the one that really was like, yeah, this is mine. I'm out there. People see my work, you know, so.
Okay, well, we'll get to some more of your filmmaking, but let's do your second song next.
Okay. We can do the song.
You want to just play the song?
Yeah.
Okay. This is song number two from our guest today, filmmaker Stacey Holman. This is What's Going On by Marvin Gaye from his 1971 album of the same name. This is three song stories, biography through music.
That takes me to the 1970s, my parents' living room. And I mentioned that we had an eclectic kind of collection of records or albums. And this one was my dad's, and still I would say is one of my dad's favorite albums, Marvin Gaye's What's Going On. And I always really enjoyed studying like the album covers because they were works of art, and they were like, they always told kind of a story depending on what was on, you know, what was inside. But this record, only my dad played, because there's like certain things that, you know, you just don't play because it's your parents. And also, too, I don't think my other siblings really were into it. But I remember when it was just looking at this album, and I just was so fascinated by the, you know, the simplicity of it. Marvin Gaye just with his trench coat on. And then just like the last shot in the back of the album where it's just this, I think it's like a swing, just empty. And I was just like, I just kind of was creating this own narrative of just like, why this, why that? I just had a sense of curiosity. And just the song, the way it starts, I mean, it's not like starts on a beat. It starts with just like people greeting each other and welcoming each other. And it was just, to my young ears, it just was an interesting kind of, it was different from all the other music that my siblings or, you know, other people were playing in the house or even really hearing on the radio. It was just something different. And of course, you know, looking back and listening to the song even now, I understand what was different. It was prophecy. It is, you know, it's telling of then and now. And it's just, it's creative genius. So it just takes me to there.
I was going to ask, and you kind of just alluded to it, but I think maybe you just were too young to really get what it was getting at back then. Like you didn't
exactly.
Really. Yeah. Yeah.
But I knew it was special. I knew there was something special about it. You know, outside of the fact that my dad was like, you know, when he played it, I do remember when he would play it, he was in a certain mood. There was a certain mood, and what that it wasn't a bad mood or a good mood. It was just a mood. My dad's a moody man. I'll just say he's a moody man, but he was in a mood. So I knew that there was something always going on what's going on? No pun intended, but there was, something.
What's going on? Dad's listening to What's Going On.
What's going on? Tell me what's going on. So there was just, you know, songs trigger stuff. You know, they can soothe, but they can also, you know, they can do many things to you. And clearly this was some kind of bomb for my dad. You know.
It was like contemplative, you know, dad time.
Exactly. 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 It's like, dad's thinking, don't bother him.
Do you have records? Do you have like, I mean, you've talked several times about album art and stuff like that. Is that something that's part of your life now?
Unfortunately, it isn't. However, I think my parents still have a lot of the albums. They do. And also, being in New York, you're so, I mean, real estate is prime here. So where would it go? You know, where could it be stored? I have funny, because I have a whole bunch of CDs in storage. And then, of course, we have, you know, Spotify and the Apple Music. But my parents did. They did save They did save it. But it's funny. I think one of my friends actually, I do have a couple albums. I have a Tony Bennett one, and it's a memorable one because he's in the foreground and we have the Twin Towers in the background.
Hmm.
So I do have one. I didn't have to figure out where that is, by the way. I think it's in storage.
Have you lived in New York City continuously since grad school?
I have. Last year was my 30th anniversary. So, I'm pretty much close to a New Yorker. But yeah, I've always wanted to live in New York. My brother went to grad school here for law, and he hated it. He hated the noise. He complained to my mom one day, like, why do they have to pick up the garbage at 4 a.m? She's like, well, because they got to pick it up sometime. So he hated it. When I came here, for his graduation, I loved it. And I was like, I want to live here. So New York has always been on my mental vision board since I was like in high school or junior high. So
when was the last time you drove a car?
When did I last drive a car? The last time I drove a car was last year sometime. I do drive a car at least once a year. I will say that.
Okay, just to make sure.
Yeah, exactly. I'm going to see my family over the Easter break. So I will be driving a car then. So yeah, that's a rite of passage when you grow up in the Midwest. Like you have to drive. But I do keep up the driving, and that's how I kind of always convince my mom, like, Mom, you know, I need to practice my driving, because she hates to let go of the steering wheel. So I'm like, I got to practice my driving. So I got to drive you around. I'll be getting myself, all, you know, my driving time in for 2024 next week.
Are you a concert goer? Are you a theater goer? You know, you're right there in the Big Apple. Have you done a lot of that or not a lot?
I've done more theater than I've done concerts. I don't like crowds that much. You know, I've gone to a few concerts, but the crowds can be like a lot for me. But you know, when I can catch some theater, I'll do that. I do like going to like summer stage, like stuff that's outdoors, which, you know, New York is great for that. I am quick to jump on that. And also it's just there's so much, because you're like, and I miss so much too. I feel as much as there's going on, I feel like there's a lot that I'm missing. But I think I would, if I had to go between the two, I definitely would do, you know, I lean more toward like theater and stuff like that when I do.
When did you form Black Butterfly Productions, and where did the name come from?
Yes. That when I finished NYU, that was like around, let me see, is that 90? That was close to, I want to say around 2000 that I formed it. And the title comes from this really incredible book that I love called Hope for the Flowers. And it's an illustrated book that is really speaks to just life in general, and just kind of, it's a good kind of barometer to see where you are with things. And just a 30-second storyline about the book. It's about two caterpillars, one named Spike and, oh my God, one named Yellow. And they meet on this caterpillar hill. And it's this hill of caterpillars that are just climbing and climbing endlessly, endlessly, that no one knows where it goes to. So they meet on this, and it's a very brutal climb. And they realize, you know what, this is not for us. And they climb off the caterpillars, because they realize this caterpillar just has to be more to life than just eating grass. And eventually Spike was like, you know what, I want to go back up that caterpillar hill and find out what's there. Meanwhile, Yellow's like, you know what, I don't. So while Spike is climbing and cutting and knocking other caterpillars off, you know, crushing their caterpillar heads, Yellow comes upon a butterfly going into a cocoon and explains, like, this is what you're supposed to be. And Yellow goes through that metamorphosis. I am just saying words that are like time to metamorphosis of what caterpillars go through. And at the same time, Spike gets to the top of the caterpillar hill, and he looks in the horizon, and there are other caterpillars' hills. You know, they're all climbing to what? Nothing. And Yellow meets him at the top as a butterfly, and he kind of picks up some hints. And all spoiler alerts, but so it's just a story, I think, of just of life. You know, we're climbing to something, and what is it? You know, is it status? Is it, you know, is it popularity? Is it, you know, endless riches? And then to what vein? And along the way, who are we hurting? Who are we harming? You know, how are we hurting ourselves? And, you know, if we are to be still and go into that metamorphosis of becoming that butterfly, you know, you're flying free, you know, and that's one of the things, butterflies are free. So that's the inspiration. And that was more than a 30-second version of how how the title, the name of the company came to be. Just kind of it's a centering spot of like, okay.
Well, I'm glad I asked, because we got like a little like Aesop's fable going on in the middle of the episode here, which is wonderful. You know, but so that means that you kind of set out that vision a long time ago. You know, mm-hmm. Now that you've made, you know, I'm trying to add it up. You've been producer, director, producer, all these different things for like, you know, I don't know, 15, 20 different things over the years, including some like the gospel thing that's on PBS right now. You know, mm-hmm. That must feel pretty good to have continued that business name with that dream to where you are now.
No, it's a gift. I mean, I should say that Black Butterfly is not part of those productions. It's not.
Oh, no, but it's you. But, I mean, yeah.
It's true. Yeah, it's me. It's me. I'm flying. I'm free. Yeah. It, that's true. That's very true. So it is kind of, it speaks to just what really the book is. Like those, you know, being, it's not so much being the outlier, it's just being true to focused on, you know, the higher good, you know, the higherness of everything, not so much what's, you know, other people are climbing to and what they're doing.
What's it like working with Henry Louis Gates Jr. or Skippy, as you told me during the Gulf Coast Life episode?
It's a joy. I really just love collaborating with him. He, you know, one thing as a producer director, when you have an executive producer, and in this case, executive producer, as well as a brand, you know, when they can trust you, and he trusts me, and that is one of a great gift as an artist, to have someone who they tell you what their idea is and they entrust you to just take that vision and run with it. And he's also too, he's not a micromanager, which is really nice. He checks in, you know, see how things are going. You show him cuts, and then you arm wrestle over stuff like, you know, should this be in it, that be in it? You know, we have our little arguments every once in a while. we always have one like argument with each of our projects, as to where I'm like, it must stay. And he's like, it must not, or this must be. And I'm like, it must not. So, overall, and then just, and he's a very generous person. You know, he is, when you're out with him in the field and interviewing, you know, he's when people want to talk to him, he'll talk to them. You know, he's not, you know, too above like dismissing anybody. You know, he'll talk to them, he'll shake hands, he'll take pictures. So I think he's very generous in that way. And he's really smart. He's a really smart guy. And you're just like, okay, well, you're going to be the smartest guy in the room right now. Hmm. But I'm the most creative person in the room. But but he's I enjoy working with him.
What are you working on now? Do you have anything you're cooking up?
I am. I have a few things that I'm developing. One that is a series, and these are not with Skip. These are my own projects. One is on house music. So I'm working on this with four other producers, three of whom are directors, and it's a history of house. So we're starting from the 19, you know, so the folks know, you know, when disco died, house was born. So from house to techno to electronic dance music, which is EDM, and the incredible phenomenon and just dollars behind that, and the global explosion of EDM, which is again house music. So that's a four-part series that we are developing and pitching and shopping. I also am working on another documentary that is going way back in time, and it's looking at the nation's capital and really how Washington D.C. became Washington D.C. and just the underlying complexity of that, which is D.C. was chosen as a nation's capital because of slavery. So We're looking at just why DC became the chocolate city, as well as why Washington and Jefferson were so adamant about making it that area instead of Philadelphia, where it was at that time being at that time. And then I'm working on something scripted, something making up. So this will be fun. I'm working with my producing partner on a series loosely based on my experience at Dillard University. I was one thing big at HBCUs, and I don't know if you're aware of this at all, but is campus queens. And to be an HBCU campus queen is a big deal because it's just a big deal. And you would get to grace the pages of Ebony magazine. And since it's no longer in print, I think they now do it digitally. So I was lucky enough to represent my college as Miss Dillard, 92-93. So the experience, the series is loosely based on a young lady who goes to an HBCU and gets just caught up in the excitement and the thrill of trying to be the campus queen, because to be the campus queen is a big deal. And her, along with four other ladies, are vying for the title of Miss. We made up a fictitious university called Rebel U. So those are kind of the three projects, and there's other stuff that I'm kind of been really just haven't really landed on where I'm going with the subject, but one's on mental health. I haven't really landed where I'm going with that, but I just know it's something that needs to be told, just not sure what part of it needs to be told by me.
Very cool. When was the last time you did something scripted?
It has been a long time. I did something, it was for one of BET Centric, which is one of BET's sister channels. I think they still exist. I believe they do exist. That was like, everything was before COVID. So it was like 2014. So it's been a minute. So I'm excited to do that. I'm looking forward to just, developing and getting that picked up by a network. It's something, A Different World, really was instrumental in my life. And we hope that this will be, have just as big an impact for our next generation.
You mean the TV show Different World?
Yeah, the TV show. That was, yes, the TV show.
That gives me the perfect segue. You are a vocal doppelganger for Karen Parsons. We had her on this show last year, maybe two years ago. And you sound exactly like her.
Oh, my. Okay, see, I'm not her, so we can make it. That's so cool. Okay. If I need anyone to play me in a whatever recording, I'll get Karen.
You guys can do each other's voices. I was gonna maybe mention it after we finished, but you you took me there. I had to do it. we're gonna get to your third song, but just just want to continue or finish up that last thought. It must be like an entirely different creative muscle doing something where you have to control it versus being able to, use the parts that you capture, either that you shoot or that other people have shot, to assemble it, right?
Yeah. No, it is. And there's also, it's a certain freedom too, a different kind of freedom, I should say, that's based on the imagination. With documentary, your imagination is based on facts. Whereas this, you are creating a world that is somewhat factual, but somewhat fantasy. And you're just upping the stakes that can be as outlandish as you want them to be. And I'm looking forward to working that muscle. I'm very excited about it.
But you also have to it's like you have to have people act like they're not acting. I know that's obvious. Like, clearly that's what actors do. But, when you're working with documentary, there's never that challenge of I'm not really buying it.
That's true. Exactly. You're like, I don't really believe that you really experienced that. But I did. But no, you're not crying because I've already cried. There's enough to I remember we were interviewing somebody. I wasn't doing the interview, but I was working with another director. And we were talking about something very sensitive to the subject. And the director kind of wanted them to cry. And I'm like, They went through their tears. Like, they worked through their tears. They're not doing, So it's just kind of not everyone's wanting to do because they're in that moment. And, but as an actor, you can say, cry, cry. You're emotional at this point. So.
All right. You ready to do your third song?
I am, yes.
So it's the Gloria Gaynor song. You want to listen to this one as well, or do you want to tell a story?
How do we want to start this one? I should tell the story to set this one up.
Okay.
Or is it better to say after? Because it's a kind of awkward, funny, interesting story. Let's play it first, and then, because I think it'll make... Yeah, let's play it first.
All right, you are in control. This is Stacey Holman's third and final song on Three Song Stories this week. This is I Will Survive by Gloria Gaynor from her 1978 album Love Tracks. Did you use the word awkward to describe the story you were going to tell? What was that word you used?
Yeah, it's kind of, it's not, I think when you hear that, I believe when we hear that song, we're just like, this is the woman's anthem. You know, this is like, yeah, I don't need you. But it's not, my memory of it is not that, you know, it's far from that. It's like the complete opposite. And that's what makes it kind of like, this is kind of awkward. But, and even the moment I shared it with my sister, because I was talking to her yesterday and I was like, did I ever tell you this? She's like, no. She's like, that's weird. But so the story behind the song, so going back to my parents' living room, it was around the 1980s, early 1980s, had to be like, it was 1981. And, you know, you remember how furniture also doubled as record players?
Oh, yeah.
Know?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So we had one of those. And 1980, 81, my parents had gotten a divorce. And so that left me the youngest. Like I said, there was an 11, 9, and 7-year age gap between my siblings, the only one in the house. And my mom had moved out of the house, so my dad kept the house. And it was an afternoon. Can't remember if it was a week. It had to probably be a weekend or something like that. And my dad got a gift, a package. And he opened it up, and it was a 45 of Gloria Gaynor's I Will Survive. And I remember him opening up the furniture / record player and putting it on. And we just sat in the living room and just listened to it, just in silence. And I don't remember how fresh in the divorce, it was pretty fresh because I was 11 and they were divorced when I was 11. So, it's interesting these memories you have that are formulated as a young kid, and the impressions they leave on you. But somebody felt led to give my dad this record as I guess an anthem for him, as you know he is now a single dad, and my mom was obviously a single mom. But not in the traditional sense. They were divorced. But and I just remember we didn't say anything after, but it was just kind of like, I think the song says it all. So.
Do you know who sent it to him?
I just, when my sister did, when I was writing it, my memory served me right. And I wasn't sure, but it was actually someone who was interested in my dad. It was not my stepmom, because she came a little bit later, but it was somebody, because my sister was like, yeah, it's probably this person. She was really on dad's coattail. So it was another woman who said it to my dad.
I was thinking if it was your mom that sent it to him, that'd mean a whole different thing.
Oh, my gosh. Exactly. Exactly. I think that was a song she was singing out when she walked out the door.
So you want to hear a random, it's sort of a coincidence, and it's multiple coincidences in a way. Are you familiar or heard of the band, the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band? They sang Mr. Bojangles. They sang the House on Pooh Corner song from the Pooh movie.
Yes.
Will the Circle Be Unbroken? They were like a folky, rocky band from like the late 60s to, well, a long time after that. One of their founders, John McEwen, he's their mandolin player, he did this show, and his first song was I Will Survive, the same song, and it was because he listened to it after he divorced his wife and he had his kids, and it was like a life-changing moment for him.
Wow.
Isn't that crazy? Yeah.
So yeah, it is the men divorce men's theme song.
I guess
that's
so. I guess so. But just how, you know, that just shows, it illustrates what we talk about on this show, how like the, you know, she sings a song, they put it onto a little piece of plastic, it goes out in the world, and suddenly it becomes this like thing that becomes a part of people's like real lives, you know?
Yeah, and it in songs, it jars the pleasant memories and hurtful memories. You know what I mean? It just, you know, someone's like, don't, you know, Casablanca, play that song again for me. You sure you want to play that? Yes, play it again. But yeah, it's so true. The power of just of sound. And I read something, this is USA Today, It doesn't matter. It was way back. And it was this whole comparison, like whose legacy would last? This is just the general, my remembrance of it. It was like Michael Jordan versus Elvis Presley. That's complicated right there. Just saying his name. So just bear with me, folks. This is an article. You can Google it. It's somewhere in the internet universe of archive articles. And the whole idea was that music will outlast, maybe outlast is the wrong word. Music has a longer legacy and bandwidth than, say, a sports athlete. Because you have to watch it, you know, as opposed to a musical artist, you can hear it, you can take it anywhere, you can cross borders and boundaries with it. And to the point, yeah, I mean, just songs like this, it crosses emotional boundaries, it triggers, you know, different memories, and it means so much to different people. So, and clearly for my dad, I think it was probably some encouragement that he needed to feel at that time. And for my 11-year-old ears, I was like, wow, this is an interesting song to give somebody.
Okay, are you ready for a speed round, Stacey?
Oh, my gosh. Okay, we've got quizzes. Yes, I'm ready.
Okay, so ready for anything. Do you have a nickname that has stuck over the course of your life you'd be willing to share?
Yes. Mary Sunshine.
Does Skippy have a nickname for you?
Darling. But he calls everybody darling.
When was the last time you purchased music that had physical form?
Oh, my gosh. Before COVID, that's all I can say. I really can't remember. That's really sad. Everything has been digital, but I feel like I did buy, I got something from my sister. Can that count?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
So this was, the Sound of Music soundtrack that I grabbed from her. Our soundtrack, album from her. And that was 2013, 2014.
Sound of Music Sound of Music rivaled Grease in my young childhood, too.
That's true. We had that album, too. So it was 2014. It was 2016, 2017. Getting my probably days mixed up. But it was, way before COVID.
Do you do karaoke?
In my house.
What would you sing if you were doing karaoke?
Oh my gosh. I would sing Blessed by Fred Hammond.
If you were
blessed in the city, blessed in the field, blessed when you,
If you were a championship wrestler, what music would you enter the arena to?
Oh, Rocky.
What would your wrestler name be?
Bad Butterfly.
Ooh. Is a hot dog a sandwich?
No. That's so random. That's a good question, though, but it could be. But no, I'm just like, ugh, hot dogs, sorry.
We're collecting data on that one. You're like guest 8. If you had to guess, what would you say is the song you've listened to the most times in your life?
Oh. I would say, what would be the song I listen most? Oh, this is a good one. Cause I'm like, well, is this song? Is it that song? Is it this song? You know, I would say, Oh gosh, this is a hard, I don't know what. Okay, I'm overthinking it. That's the problem. I'm overthinking it. So I'm not going to overthink it, and I'm just going to say a song. But I would say the song that I've listened to probably most in my life would be I'm doing really good in this flash round. So okay, let me just take myself out of it. Okay, so I think the song that kind of comes to mind that I would say listen to, I'm just gonna say, but that song I really listen to a lot. This is the thing. I feel like there's certain, I'm going, when I go through certain phases, I'm gonna get this song, and there's that song, and there's this song, and there's that
Said if
song.
you had to guess.
If I had to guess, I know. You said if I had to guess, I would say, gonna say Fly Me to the Moon. I'm gonna say Tony Bennett. I'm gonna say Fly Me to the Moon.
That's a great answer. If you could broadcast a song into the head of all humans in one collective moment, which song would you choose?
Oh, Let There Be Peace on Earth.
Is that a song?
I think it's called Let There Be Peace on Earth.
Sounds like a sentiment. I mean, it probably is a song. I just don't know who this is.
I don't think no one really, I think it's all sheet music, but you know what? I think I would sing
It's by Harleen Wood. Let
Okay.
There Be Peace on Earth and Let It Begin With Me.
Oh, yeah. I remember it now that it has a second thing on there.
And there's another one says Let There Be Peace on Earth, song by Vince Gill.
Oh, that's probably not the
Oh,
one she's thinking of, but who knows?
yeah. Yeah, I mean that song sounds so like, I mean it's a good song, but yeah, I guess it would be Let There Be Peace on Earth. It sounds so like kumbaya tree hugging, doesn't it?
No, that's okay though. You're giving it, it's you get to
I guess
nudge humanity, right?
in the climate that we're in, I'm like, oh, or you know what it would be? Yeah, no, that would be it. That would be it.
Do you
Yeah.
ever listen to albums like in their continuous wholeness now, or are you all piecemeal?
Depends. Sometimes I will do piecemeal. Other times I'll listen to like whole albums. Like I love there's an album with Duke Ellington and oh my gosh, what's his name? It's a duet with okay, that's yeah, I'm drawing. Whoa, come on, memory. So maybe not that one, but yes, I do listen to albums in its entirety. Like one I do like listening to since like John Coltrane, this duet album with John Coltrane and Duke Ellington. That's just beautiful. Then, Sketches of Spain, I really like listening to. And yeah, and sometimes I'll listen to right now, I feel like I've been listening to some blues, that blues, some jazz, and I'm kind of feeling I want to start listening to some more Dinah Washington. I have like an old soul music too, I realize. Like I like a lot of 40s stuff and 50s and 30s.
Have you ever been putting together a film project and you really, really wanted a particular song but just couldn't get it because the licensing was too much?
We were doing we well we were doing The Black Church, and there was a song again by Marvin Gaye, and I was like, I want to do this song, and then we just kind of realized, just forget it, we can't use it because it was going to be too much money. So, yeah.
Okay, what would your 14-year-old self think of who you are today?
Oh, she'd be proud. She
Yeah.
would be proud. You're like, you're awesome. You're doing it.
Would she be
You're
stoked that you'd been living in New York City for so long?
Oh, she would be ecstatic. She would just be ecstatic. She's like, she would be like, you did it. You're doing it. But she would love that I would be in New York.
All right, Stacey, it's time for you to recommend three people that you think we have a shot at getting on that you'll at least share it with and tell them that you were on something.
Oh yeah. I mean, there's a, actually I thought of like four people, but the three top three people, and she actually was in, and she's from Florida. She was in the series Gospel and Black Church, is Fredera Hadley. She's at Juilliard, and she is just amazing, just incredible. The other person is Sam Pollard. He's my mentor. He's done incredible work in documentaries and is just a legend. in the doc world. And he just loves me. He just did the Max Roach documentary. So he's, he's just brilliant. Love him. And I would also recommend my cohort, Shayla. She's, you know, the other half of the Black Church and Gospel and Making Black America. And just her musical knowledge and love is just incredibly rich. And so those would be my three.
We would love to have them. The first one, you said she was in Gospel. Was she in the first episode of Gospel? Was she the singer?
She's a musicologist.
Okay. Yeah. I was trying to think of who it might be because I did see the first one.
She has short hair. She's wearing a black shirt. And she's the one, if you remember in episode 2, when Mahalia Jackson and Martin Luther King.
Yeah.
And she's the one who sets up that.
I totally remember. Okay, cool. Well,
she has great friends with Shirley Caesar. So she's just brilliant all around.
Okay, well, share this with them. Connect us with them. We can obviously do it remotely. We love to try to branch out that way. But that's the end of the train. Do you have any final thoughts you want to leave us with, Stacey?
Well, first of all, thank you. This has been a joy. And just, you know, music is a heartbeat and music is so important. And just as creators, a lot of us, and I should speak specifically for me, ideas are sparked by music, by a song, by a verse. And it's so intricate in daily life and the creative life. So I'm happy to just think about these memories and just, I've been smiling and dancing and like bopping my head. So this has been great.
For this week's parting tune, we're going back to February of this year when I had Stacey on the other show I host, Gulf Coast Life, to talk about her role in creating the 4-part PBS show Gospel. She's its series producer and director. In watching that show to prepare for that conversation, I was introduced to a song and a style of recording from the 1920s when some preachers would record brief messages, kind of like sermons, that were followed by a song driving home their message. The one they used in Gospel is called Stay Out of the Chain Stores, and holy moly, does it still work today with the Walmarts and Amazons of the world and the struggles of local businesses.
When you get your money, you better be for sure. Then give it to your wife. Lord, better stay out of the chain store.
We make 3-Song Stories in the studios of WGCU Public Radio on the campus of Florida Gulf Coast University in Fort Myers, Florida. Richard Chinqui is co-creator and producer. Tara Callaghan is host and online content producer. Our production assistant is Jared Gonzalez. Chris Duffus is our executive producer. And our theme song was made by Dave Cowan and Stick Martin at Monkey House Studio in St. Pete. Keep listening.